Okay. Great turnout tonight. Welcome everybody. Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Welcome back.
Oh, thank you. I've been on the road. So glad to be back. So welcome to Dallas Lawsers Forum. And every once in a while, I'd like to ponder on what do we mean by philosophy. So, Ben, you're a philosophy professor. What do we mean by philosophy?
Well, I can give you several different definitions. One that I like is the analytic and synthetic use of reason.
Analytic and synthetic use of reason. That's very good. I like that. So, Brian, what would be another good definition?
Finding theological aspects of ordinary discourse and bearing out inconsistencies.
Yeah, finding inconsistencies in normal discourse, critical thinking. The noun philosophy means the study of proper behavior and the search for wisdom. Aren't we all searching for wisdom in one way or another? Mm-hmm. The original meaning of the word philosophy comes from the Greek word philo, meaning love, and sophos, or wisdom. When someone studies philosophy, they want to understand how and why people do certain things and how to live a good life. In other words, they want to know the meaning of life. And the suffix "-ers" of philosophy, and you get a word for someone whose job it is to think these big thoughts. And that's why we're here today, because we're interested in big thoughts. Dallas Lawsers Forum is a non-for-profit organization dedicated to bringing philosophy, ideas, and intellectual discussion to the DFW area. I'm Rob Olson. I want to thank everybody for coming out. We meet the second and fourth Tuesday of the month from September through May, and I was just curious, do we have any first-time visitors? Okay, now how did you hear about us, sir?
Heard about it.
Okay, great. Have a few, sir.
Well, my big brother comes here, so he told me about it.
Rob?
No.
Oh, okay, so you're Mr. McKellar.
I am indeed, Mr.
McKellar. Oh, okay. You're going to be speaking in the spring.
Yes, I'm looking forward to it.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Okay, anybody else? Yes, sir. Oh, fantastic. Okay, you have several members of that come here, including our esteemed speakers tonight. Anybody else? Oh, yes. Tell us how do you find out about us?
My daughter is very interested, so I'm calling for your question.
Fantastic. Okay, yes, you've been here before, young lady, haven't you?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, well, welcome to everybody. If you haven't paid already, please do so immediately after lecture. So David Drum is our treasurer, and he's not always the first one here. He has a day job. And so anyway, if you could make sure that you pay him afterwards, we would really appreciate that. It's $5, unless you're a student with ID. If you're a student without an ID, it's still $2. So we'll take your word for it. If you want to become a subscriber, the cost is $35 for 6 months. And also, I just want to remind everybody to pay their bill for the dinner. Sometimes someone might forget, and we have to pay for that. And philosophy is not free. It's not cheap, and it's not free either. So we have a website. Ken Sauter, he handles our AV, he handles our website, he is superb, and we're so fortunate to have him helping us out. And so that website is www.philosophersforum.org. You can sign up our email list on the website. And then if you enjoy it, please forward that on to friends and family. We're trying to build our community here of philosophers. There's also a meetup app. You can go online and sign up on the meetup, right, Ken? You can go on.
I believe so. Skip manages that.
Skip handles that, right. Skip Kilmer, Skip, it's right here. Skip is our secretary and handles our meetup and does a great job for us as well. So our speaker will spend about 50 minutes or so speaking on this very exciting topic. And then we'll open up to questions. So on the questions, we ask you to make a short statement, one or two or three sentences, and then get to your question. And then last, please turn off your cell phones and put them on vibrate mode at this time. We are very privileged to have Dr. David Alkeck with us tonight. He's a longtime friend, brilliant man, lots of fun, a great speaker. Born in Victoria, Texas. Anybody from Victoria besides David? You're the only one from Victoria, Texas. He graduated from the University of Texas in Austin and the University of Texas Southwestern Medical School in Dallas. And he was in Parkland Hospital when they brought in JFK. He was in that general area when they brought in President Kennedy after he was shot. He's board certified in dermatology, where he later specialized in cosmetic surgery. How did he do on me?
You can hardly tell.
He wouldn't give me my money back. That's great.
Used to be a beautiful woman. Back surgery.
I want my money back. And he said, no, there's no guarantees on my facial surgery. In addition, he is a published author of 15 medical articles, 2 chapters in a textbook, and 4 books. He has completed his 5th, a memoir, and his 6th, a science fiction. And he's also a poet. He won an award that was not in his official bio. He's a humble man, but he won an award for best poetry book in the state of Texas. So we're all very proud. And he's also a past president of Dallas Foster's Forum and an esteemed board member. He'll be speaking tonight about sci-fi, philosophy, and science fiction. And now, please join me in welcoming Dr. David Alkeck.
It is now.
Now?
Yeah,
can you hear me, everybody?
No.
I have to type peek-a-boo around this post or so. And now that Rob has told you all about philosophy, and you know, I don't have to talk at all. We're going to talk about, though, some fun stuff, philosophy in science fiction. And, you know, science fiction as a genre is considered by a lot of people as interesting but trivial, you know, trivial. And, but, you know, in its more serious aspects, it engages us in political, religious, sociological, metaphysical, ethical questions, you know. It poses us, points us, you know, to a future, and so we can see possible questions, possible answers to these questions. And this talk's going to be, this talk could be a whole course, because we've got so many things that we can talk about, like that. And I'm going to leave this up here so we can kind of go through these things as we go through these issues. Now, these and other questions have fertilized the imagination of authors of science fiction, TV, movies. They've also been examined as imaginary places and times by philosophers such as Plato, Descartes, Thomas Mann, Thomas More, Aldous Huxley, and scientists such as Carl Sagan, Stephen Jay Gould, and Stephen Hawking. Subjects such as cosmology, evolution, science, computer technology, even the theories of quantum mechanics and relativity are explored in science fiction. And like I said, each of these questions could take a whole lecture, okay? So I'm just going to go over, kind of touch them, and with some we're going to go into a little more detail than others. Okay, and I assume that even though you may not have seen these movies or read these books, at least you may be familiar with them. In the movie The Matrix, that examines the same issues that plague Rene Descartes. How do we know what is real? What is true? And the basis of that knowledge. As Morpheus, in the character, put it to Neo, the main character, quote, "Have you ever had a dream, Neo, that you know
that you were so sure was real? What if you were unable to wake from that dream? How would you know the difference between the dream world and the real world? Unquote. Descartes also realized, you know, he could be dreaming and he could be being deceived by his evil demon. And the Matrix is kind of a variation. So instead of the evil demon, we have the Matrix. The idea is that you can't know for sure that you aren't being fooled, okay? That you can't know for sure if the world you live in is real. That you aren't a simulation. If you can't know something as basic as that, then it seems you can't know anything at all, for certain. But knowledge doesn't require certainty. It only requires, you can't positively prove anything. Knowledge is justified true belief. You are justified in believing that which is most likely. In the movie, the Matrix, Cypher, who was in the movie, he wants to trade his difficult life outside the Matrix for a blissful, problem-free, wonderful life inside the Matrix, his make-believe life. The moral of the film isn't that this is what a person should want, you know, even though it's an ignorant life, that ignorance is not bliss, ignorance is slavery. It takes courage to seek and embrace the truth, even if it makes life hard, and the truth is uncomfortable. You should not just believe what you want to believe, as the blue pill allows you to, you should take the red pill and seek the truth, whatever the cost. What about free will and determinism? Famous, this is a great subject that our president really loves. Okay, in The Matrix Reloaded, there's a sequel to that. It examines this question. When the Oracle, who supposedly could kind of foretell the future, the Oracle offered Neo a piece of candy. He asked her if she knew beforehand whether he was going to take the candy or not, then was he really free to take it? According to the philosopher Nelson Pike, to freely choose to do something, you must have alternate possibilities. Choosing and not choosing are both possible. The Merovingian in that movie later tells Morpheus, quote, choice is an illusion created between those with power and those without. There is only one constant, one universal causality. Action and reaction, cause and effect. Causality, there's no escape from it. We are forever slaves to it, unquote. So he's echoing this determinism argument. And this goes back to Aristotle's first cause, Democritus, and Laplace as philosophers. Aristotle, of course, posed that everything and every event had a cause. Cause, effect. Cause before that, cause. So there's a regression of causes back to a first cause, uncaused, that the Christians call God. Democritus theorized that all matter is composed of individual invisible particles called atoms. And then after Newton expounded his theory, his laws of physics, Laplace, a French mathematician, said, okay, if we know the position and velocity of every atom in the universe, then we should be able to determine everything that came before that, everything that came after that is predetermined. Okay? When asked by Napoleon
what the role of God had in this universe. Laplace famously replied, "I have no need for that hypothesis." Okay, if determinism is true, then everything is a consequence of the laws of physics. Right, Rob?
Right.
And past events. No human has a choice or control over the laws of physics. If our brain is another part of that physical world, then you could basically look at all the wiring in the brain and all the synapses and how it's wired and fired, and then you could predict everything that the brain would think or do from then on. It would not have a choice. But technically, Rob, this is wrong. The universe is not deterministic. Quantum mechanics has taught us that. The position and velocity of a subatomic particle is indeterminable. And thus, an event may go one of several ways. Unfortunately, however, the randomness of quantum mechanics doesn't rescue free will either. Indeterminism is just as incompatible with free will as determinism is. But some philosophers have suggested an alternate view of this. It's called compatibilism, that free will and determinism are compatible. An agent that is a human's action is free as long as it's the result of a conscious, rational, deliberative process. System 2 from Kahneman, the slow thinking. If the agent thinks about what to do, and then in this process causes the agent's action, then the agent acted freely. Okay, this brings up the theoretical possibility of the brain in a vat. We could upload your brain into a vat, wired so that all the stimuli that we see, and you were experiencing them just as you experienced them in real life. Would you have free will? Would you realize that wasn't reality? Would you realize that you were a simulation? And then the most important question is, would you prefer this blissful, problem-free, even maybe perpetual existence? I doubt if you would. I hope you wouldn't. Okay, so for another point of determinism, let's talk about time travel. H.G. Wells and his story, this was the early 20th century, I believe, was the first fiction writer to place his novel in a time rather than a place, of a time machine, he called it. And in this, his imaginary world, he went like 20,000 years into the future or whatever. We'll talk more about utopias and dystopias later. His time machine was rather low-tech as far as we're concerned. But in the movie Interstellar, it gives a plausible explanation for time travel of a sense. Okay, bear with me now. Because of the effect of gravity on space-time, if you have the closer you get to a very dense, high-gravity object like a black hole, the slower time passes for you. The space-time around this massive object becomes kind of thick, like a circle. And so you just kind of slow down as you go through it. And the closer you get to it, the slower time gets relative to the outside. Okay? For example, let's say Charmin, my wife, is in a spaceship and she's going into a black hole. She's approaching a black hole. I, far away, am observing her. To me, her spaceship slows down as she approaches the event horizon. And it seems to me that it takes forever. And if it does take forever for me, for her ship to actually pass that event horizon. To her and her spaceship, it's as if time is not normal to her. She's just going along like she always has been. So the relative thing is different. So so I'm aging at my present time. She's not aging hardly at all. Okay. So in the movie Interstellar, the hero goes to a planet close to a supermassive black hole, where every hour he spends there is 7 years back on Earth. And when he returns back to Earth, he sees that his daughter is now dying of old age, older than he is. Has he traveled in time? Well, relative to himself, he has. Relative to the people that he left, he has. According to Paul Lewis's definition of time travel, an object travels if, and only if, the difference between its departure and arrival time as measured in the surrounding world does not equal the distance, the duration of the journey undergone by the object. In other words, it's different, the reference time is different from the person that's actually traversing. Okay, so what about travel in the past? So in Interstellar, he sort of traveled to the future then, because he, in his time dilation, he hasn't aged, and the reference point has, so when he goes back to it, he's kind of gone to the future, to their future. So what about travel in the past? In the movie Interstellar, they use kind of hocus-pocus in traveling through a black hole in a fifth dimension. And this is where you can get into paradoxes. Paradoxes and things called causal loops and genies. A causal loop, according to philosophy, is you can't have A without B, but you can't have B without A. Kind of an impossible situation. For example, in the movie Back to the Future, remember Back to the Future? Doc uses his time machine to go to the past to teach himself how to make a time machine. Causal loop. And the time machine, his time machine, is a genie. It has no causal beginning. See? Okay. The Terminator. Okay. In the Terminator, the robot comes to Earth, comes back to the past from the future in order to kill Sarah Connor, who is supposed to be the mother of John Connor, the leader of the resistance. Okay, and the man follows the Terminator to save her. Well, in the process, he falls in love with Sarah Connor and gets her pregnant. And she has a baby. And who is the baby? John Connor. Wouldn't have had John Connor if he didn't. You see the causal loop, and John Connor is a genie. Has no causal beginning. Okay, other paradoxes involve going back in time, causing the death of your parent. If you caused the death of your parent, then you wouldn't be born, then you wouldn't have died. You see, it's kind of a weird thing. So things like causal loops and other paradoxes are logically impossible. That which is logically impossible can't be true. And that's the philosophic explanation. The physical explanation is a little easier. All matter and energy in the universe is constant. You can change from one to the other, E equals MC squared, but you don't create new matter or new energy. Okay, it's constant. If I go back to the past and see my other self, I've doubled the mass of myself in that universe. So that's not a lot. That, you can't have that. The other explanation is entropy. Entropy, as you know, well, I'm not going to explain what entropy is, but it always increases. The mixed-upness of the universe increases, always. You can't put the egg back in the shell. You can't have the effect before the cause. Okay? So the kicker bee is an arrow of time that you can't go against. All right, let's look at AI. Okay. Let's examine the idea of intelligence, sentience, consciousness. Human intelligence, the ability to solve problems, and make decisions, understand language, that's part of our mindedness. But we also have subjective experiences such as emotions, memories, sensory interpretations. In other words, consciousness. We're also self-aware, aware of our own awareness, and that other humans share this self-awareness. It's called theory of mind. If I know that I have a mind, then other humans that are like me have minds too. That's theory of mind. The question is whether machines can one day be sentient, conscious, self-aware. Some of the religious persuasion would say that no, machines can't do that because they have no souls. Well, the notion that humans have souls is problematic too. If ensoulment is required for sentience, well then humans may not be sentient either. Not to mention other sentient animals such as dogs, dolphins, apes. Those who say that machines can't have souls just means that they can't have minds or conscious experiences. But someday they might. So let's extend our future mindedness and imagination to an android. That is a machine that looks and acts like a human being. Isaac Asimov created such characters, and so did Steven Spielberg in his movie AI, Artificial Intelligence, with his little character, David. David is a new breed, able to acquire an inner world of thought. His ability to dream and have human emotions such as love and loss, fear and rejection. Any person who's watching that movie really becomes involved with David and can't help reacting to him as if he is a sentient being with feelings. So let's apply the Turing test. The Turing test, Alan Turing said that if you're listening to a human and a machine and you're asking questions and you can't tell which is which, then the machine is people, So let's call it a mega Turing test. Actually, two individuals, a human and an android, interacting with each other, talking. And if you can't tell the difference, then the android is sentient. Okay? Now, by this definition, David certainly is sentient. The droids in Star Wars, they behave as if they're sentient. They use language, they make plans, they feel fear and loss and concern, but they're not treated as sentient. They're treated as machines, as slaves. So, what about the dangers of AI? Ray Kurzweil, in his book, The Singularity is Near, predicted that by 2029, that's not too long from now, computers would pass the Turing test. And nanobots would be able to take care of most disease. By the 2030s, we would understand the human brain enough to upload someone's neural structure to a computer or a robotic body, an android. It may happen in some of our lifetimes. Kurzweil's production may be far off, but we still have to consider the unintended consequences. Some of the consequences of AI may be good, maybe we shouldn't forego them, maybe they may help us help with the environmental catastrophes that we're having. It's probably also going to have mixed results. Some androids could take over the world, you know, theoretically like the Terminator. But also uploading our brains into an android body, we could live for a long, long, long time. Okay, the role of philosophy enters this consideration of AI, mostly in that of ethics. Can we program a sense of morality, of right and wrong, of doing the right thing into a machine? How should we treat androids if we develop them? Would it be okay to make them do slave work, cook our meals, clean sewers, fight our wars? Would they be disposable? Or would they have legal rights that we would be morally obligated to respect? And this goes back to our previous discussion. If we know that androids are sentient, then they would have rights. Our moral centeredness come from rights that we don't want to harm or hurt someone because they feel pain. So if an android feels pain, aren't we obligated not to hurt? If we say that it can't feel pain and are justified in treating it as an object, then aren't we as guilty as the people who treated the Negro slaves, the Chinese railroad workers, and the Jews of Nazi Germany the same way? The invention of AI will force us to face moral dilemmas like this in our history. We will be gods who create sentient beings. Okay, what about good versus evil and moral ambiguity? The original Star Wars, black and white, good and evil, so much so that Luke Skywalker and the Rebel Alliance wore white, and Darth Vader and the Emperor wore black. John Williams' songs, the theme song for the good guys was in a major chord, and for the bad guys was in a minor chord. But in the prequels, there's more ambiguity. Palpatine, who was the evil emperor, tries to turn Anakin to the dark side by convincing him that the Jedi are evil, wanting to hold on to their own power while attacking the Republic. That's true. He has a point there. The right course is not to have, for example, army generals, which are today's Jedi, you might say, forcefully remove an elected president from power or assassinate him. Proper law enforcement should do that by impeachment or the courts. Okay, that brings up political rebellion. Some SF plots involve rebellion against a cruel despotism like the Hunger Games. So we get into political rebellion, and if it's just justified on utilitarian grounds, what are the points? First, justification of a rebellion shouldn't turn on whether it succeeds or not. If a government is so corrupt it needs to be overthrown, then do it. It's noble cause even if it fails. Second, just because something has utilitarian benefit, does it make it morally justified? You could make 95% of the people of this country happy by enslaving 5%, but that wouldn't be right. So that's why terrorism is morally wrong, because it targets innocent civilians, even if it would save more lives in the long run. And three, what justifies our government in the first place? What morally binds us to obey its laws? If it fails in its duty to protect life, liberty, and property of its citizens, then it is morally permissible to disobey its laws and to rebel against it. Let's go to the next topic. Alien contact with extraterrestrial life. Let's look at moral implications. If we should come into contact with alien intelligence, we may consider if we are the superior civilization visiting their home, are they being the superior close civilization visiting us? Think about what happened when European colonists contacted the civilizations of the Americas, Asia, and Africa. The proponents of colonization at that time justified their actions by saying they brought the blessings of civilization, of Christianity, of sound government and laws, of technology. Post-colonial arguments are they destroyed or completely submerged peaceful, organized societies and forced religious conversion and slavery on them. So, some consider wrong to impose one's culture, one culture's moral code on another. Moral relativism is false. It is true that there are no objective morals about how our culture dresses or eats or prays, but some acts are universally immoral. We consider them immoral. Killing babies for sport. Incest. Rape. Murder. Slavery. One culture may impose slavery on another get rid of it, eliminate it. So imposing one's culture on another is not necessarily bad, but not necessarily good either. Stephen Hawking made a pronouncement, though. He was very pessimistic about this problem because of our history of a superior, quote, advanced culture coming into contact with a not so advanced. What would happen if we humans came across life on another planet but didn't recognize it as such? Because we couldn't communicate with it. What would happen if a much more advanced alien intelligent species discovered us? What would happen if they looked on us as merely intelligent animals, like dogs, like we do, dogs, dolphins, chimpanzees, apes? Would we or they be morally upright discoverers or exploiting conquerors? How you see the world is influenced by the conceptual framework of language. Think dogs, chimps, dolphins again. They have a type of communication, but we can't communicate with them. So aliens who evolve on a different planet under completely different conditions would very likely utilize language in a completely different way. Radically different from our own. In the movie Arrival, the lady scientist is trying to communicate with alien intelligence that communicates by throwing out inkblots, more or less. A little smoke thing of an inkblot sort of thing. How do you communicate with that? Well, she had to devise a way to do that. And that may be our problem, you see. They're not going to speak English. All right, let's change the subject to something that's very popular, post-apocalypse. What would be the results of a catastrophe such as an asteroid impact or super volcano, climate change, man-made cataclysms such as atomic war, pandemic, or AI taking over like in the Terminator? Let's not argue about the causes of global warming right now, just the fact that it's happening. So if there is global warming, or the opposite, an intense ice age, there's going to be decrease in food production, decrease in energy production, scarcity. Will there then be a cooperation among the survivors, or a reversion
to primitive, competitive, dog-eat-dog existence. Will Rousseau or Hobbes be right? It depends on how optimistic or pessimistic you are about human nature. Are humans basically good or bad? Selfish or altruistic? Competitive or cooperative? Or both? And if they are both, then which one is going to be better, predominant? What about the questions of overpopulation? Okay, in a related subject, euthanasia, etc. In the movie Soylent Green, I don't know if many people remember that, but that was made in 1973 and set in 2022, 3 years ago. Overpopulation and food scarcity, you know, was the plague, this dystopia. And food for the people is made by the Soylent Corporation and these little wafers that they picked up and consumed. Well, the hero, who was Carlton Heston, I believe, discovered the big secret of Soylent Green, that people that were sent to euthanasia centers to give up their life was made out of those people. Same outside of Soylent Green was made out of disposable people. Okay, in another movie, Logan's Run, was a little different. Everybody was happy. Nobody lived over age 30. At that age, they were told, you know, to go to reincarnation centers where they would be born again as a baby and reincarnate. Well, the truth was that they were just put to death there. They were just eliminated for overpopulation. So this is forced euthanasia. Forced euthanasia is tantamount to murder. But what about voluntary euthanasia? Suicide or assisted suicide? An elderly person with terminal cancer or advanced dementia isn't really living. He or she is just waiting to die. Should people be allowed to decide for themselves when their lives are no longer worth living? If so, shouldn't they have the right to ask a doctor to help them in their lives in a safe and painless way? Question. Okay. So, now let's shift our attention to the opposite side, the beginning. Not the end of life, but the beginning of life. And reproduction. Some of this applies to overpopulation. Questions are birth control, abortion, sterilization. We're going to leave the question of abortion for some other time. Let's consider gene manipulation and designer babies. In the future, we will be able to extend in vitro fertilization to ex utero fertilization, ex utero incubation of fetuses. Sperm is taken from one, eggs from another, put into a medium, and you grow a baby. So, therefore, sex will be for recreation, not procreation. Not only will we be able to weed out bad genes, as we can do to this day to some extent, we'll also be able to select for favorable ones for our designer babies. We've talked about this before. But, okay, H.G. Wells knew nothing about gene manipulation when he wrote The Time Machine. In his time machine, nature kind of took its course and the surface humans were beautiful, but effete individuals, and those that lived beneath the surface were brutish workers who really, really ran things. However, once the practice of gene manipulation becomes common, our evolution as a species will not be natural, but unnatural selection, not random mutation. And new species will arise. We will become Homo Deus, God-like man.
This, of course, will happen far faster in rich, technologically advanced societies. And so we're going to see an extreme here, okay? Rich, technologically advanced societies are going to take advantage of technology and gene manipulation and have more superior offspring. And so there's going to be a much bigger divide between those that have and those that have not. Okay. Now, I want y'all to kind of get on the light side here. We've been talking about some heavy stuff. Okay. Let's talk about cloning. Let's say that they're able to clone you, okay? And you have sex with your clone. Just imagine it a minute. You have sex with your clone. Okay, the question is that incest or masturbation? Think about it.
I'd rather not.
If you're having sex with your phone, it can't be heterosexual.
Well, there's arguments around this. Okay. Sorry. Okay. We're going to talk about utopias and dystopias. We kind of touched on this a little bit. I suppose the first utopias were philosophical in nature. Plato's, a Republic, Thomas More's Utopia, which means nowhere, Rousseau, Voltaire, even Karl Marx. Their utopias were places, sometimes isolated. H.G. Wells was the first to place his into a future, so his was really science fiction. Utopian subjects dealt with the economy, government, crime and punishment, relations with an outside world, and religion. All were, of course, fictional, but not until H.G. Wells would be considered scientist. The 17th century utopias were filled with a new strength of scientific import. That was an age of reasons. Francis Bacon came out with his definition of scientific method, and Isaac Newton's writings came out. And in this age of reason, there was an enormous optimism, the wonder of political science and its promises. But there was also a skepticism that appeared that science may undermine religion. The 18th century utopias became satirical, or anti-utopian. Voltaire's satire can be put kind of Leibniz's best of all possible worlds. Leibniz, great mathematician who discovered their calculus along with Isaac Newton, said, well, if God is a perfect person and he created this world, it must be the best. It must be the best of all possible worlds. Well, Voltaire said, I don't know about that. Why would he create this earthquake in Lisbon on a Sunday when all these people were in church and were crushed to death? Would a good God, you know, do that? Anyway, another subject. So, then we have Karl Marx, of course, was crowned the 19th century and his influences to this day. After World War I and II, utopias became more dystopias, bad utopias. The Rouse time machine depicted evolution going wrong, and this genre was continued with the other big two, Brave New World by Aldous Huxley and 1984 by George Orwell. The tensions in these books were scarcity, security versus freedom, chaos versus conformity, and static versus kinetic societies. These were epitomized, of course, by the fascist and communist regimes of the 20th century. Personal freedom versus security is a frequent subject. When does society have the right to restrict a person's free will? What about conversion therapy for homosexuals? Look what the UK did to Alan Turing, the Julian Mann, who invented the computer, was a homosexual. And in that time, it was considered illegal in Great Britain, and he was forced to have chemical castration, and he eventually committed suicide. What a loss. With the advent of the Cold War and possible atomic holocaust, there was a lot of post-apocalyptic fiction and described the societies that have survived them, like Mel Gibson's thing in the desert, or Road Warrior. Yeah, Road Warrior. And all of the subsequent sequels of that. Okay. There are basically four scenarios with post-apocalypse. Those due to a technological thing like atomic war, those due to a biomedical thing like a pandemic, environmental one like climate change or supervolcano asteroid, and number four, a super intelligence like AI or alien invasion. We're led to examine the moral as well as the physical aspects, though, of post-apocalypse, okay? Will the resulting society afterward be a good society, a utopia, or a bad one, a negative one? Will it be morally good or bad? Will it have new moral dimensions, or new foundations? Technological, economic, political, and moral degradation may result in totalitarianism, theocracy, total anarchy, or barbarism? Or can a more perfect society rise from the cataclysmic ashes? Science fiction, you know, just explores these possibilities. Many thinkers and writers of the subject deem real utopias impossible, unrealistic. A utopia cannot be built to perfect efficiency, happiness, and justice by humans who are always imperfect, chaotic, and unpredictable, by definition. Michael Shermer says utopias are especially vulnerable when a social theory based on collective ownership, communal work, authoritarian rule, and a command and control economy collides with a natural born desire for autonomy, individual freedom, and choice. He prefers the term protopia, which is a kind of a gradual, incremental improvement in steps toward a better society, not perfection. A protopian future in this view is not only realistic, but realizable. And I think that's hopefully where our society is heading today. So this begs the question, what does it mean to be human? And what is our value as a species? Are we just one of several intelligent species on a insignificant planet around a mediocre star near the edge of one of 100 billion or more galaxies? So, science fiction stretches kind of our imagination to think about questions like this. So even though all literature is imaginative, and science fiction in particular is very imaginative, it does force us to think about serious and sometimes philosophical issues. What is the future of our civilization, our environment, our planet? What form will they take from given various possibilities? And what about the cosmos itself? You know, after 15 billion years or so, will we expand somehow, you know, beyond our insignificant little world to the vast unknown? Are we going to be physically able to do that? How will humanity's role evolve when it is faced with AI, environmental catastrophe, or alien contact? These are big questions that science fiction may explore, but our descendants will certainly eventually face. Science fiction is a predictor, a sort of window into the future. I warned you, I told you that I would just touch on these subjects that could go on forever. So, one little thing here. Come on. So what are the answers? Some of the answers that science fiction proposes. First, look beyond the entertainment value of science fiction to the philosophic issues it raises. Expand your imagination horizon. Let it expand out there. Be open to possibilities that science affords, AI, for example, gene manipulation, and work toward a better future. And I'm sure you have 1,000 questions that I will be unable to answer, but I will try.
Okay, thank you so much. So once again, I just ask if you have questions to try and keep your comments to a minimum and get your question. So who's first? Okay.
Has anyone, science fiction author or philosopher, took at the question of whether, because of our, I guess, evolution as physical creature, subject to a lot of sociobiology that caused our, you know, our outlook on the world to basically be whatever was pro-survival, that we have so many built-in biases in our perception of the world that there's no way we can ever completely understand the properties of the universe. So we rose out of the book. And so we have, we're hardwired with a lot of biases and limitations. Can we ever get beyond that?
So you're asking if science fiction writers have explored the biases,
or whether everyone anyways considered whether some other intelligence,
of course,
just an evolutionary background, maybe AI can perceive things or totally blind to.
Way back in the 50s, I remember seeing a movie called This Island Earth, in which an alien, you know, species came to visit us, and they had these huge brains. I mean, great, they were super intelligent. So yes, they did talk about, you know, super intelligence. And others have talked about human beings becoming more intelligent and more, you know, capable. With parapsychology, you know, things like precognition and, you know, that sort of thing.
You mentioned the grandfather paradox.
What?
The grandfather paradox, where you go back in time and, like, you kill your grandfather,
right.
And you said that was impossible.
Yes.
But quantum mechanics seems to indicate that we have multiple universes. So what about you go back and kill your grandfather, and what you do is you create another timeline. Your timeline still exists, but then there's another timeline where you don't exist.
I understand.
So, what about that?
But physics says that within each universe, mass and energy is constant. So if you go from one universe to another, which we can't do, we can't go from one universe
to
another.
How do you know?
Well, so far we can, anyway.
That we know.
Here's the physicist.
I'm not sure what I'm asking is a real question, so feel free not to answer it. You brought up two ideas that I don't know that science fiction has put together. We've got AI, which we use to solve problems. That's why we do it. You know, solve all kinds of real problems once we state the problem correctly. We have philosophy, which is what you described. It's how we create meaning, maybe. What if we put AI into solving that problem?
Good question.
Thanks.
And certainly, we do create super intelligent AI that can answer questions very, very solve very complex problems fast. would they be able to answer moral questions or questions of theology? I read a story, bear with me, that might go along with this. This is way in the future, and humanity has, you know, gone across the universe and has built a computer which takes up an entire planet. It's so powerful that it can answer any question. So the two men are in this ceremony that's being beamed across the universe are to throw the switch, and they ask it the question everybody has always wanted to know the answer to. Is there a God? And a bolt of lightning struck the two men dead and fused the switch shut and said, there is now. I hope AI becomes conscious enough to do that, but we have to imbue that into a moral question. Yeah.
Okay. Are you next?
You're next.
Okay, I'm next. I'm looking around the room. There's a contemporary philosopher who bugs the heck out of me. Swedish-born Nick Bostrom. Has anybody heard of this guy?
Yes.
Proposed the simulation hypothesis.
Yes.
Oh, wait, this is not the way that he puts it. This is just the way that I'm putting it. Basically, the good news, everybody, is we've all survived climate change and the mass extinction event, because guess what? We're all living here. The bad news is we're probably living in a simulation, meaning that if humanity survives this bottleneck that we're in now, yes?
Yes.
What, am I not on the
No, I couldn't hear you.
Oh, so I have to restate all this?
Okay,
I shall try. The good news is, if we're all here listening to one another, humanity has survived the bottleneck that we're in now, with the mass extinction event and climate change, and we're in an advanced technological society that has the ability to simulate enormously complex realities, and we're interested in ourselves. So we run a bunch of simulations on ourselves to see, you know, alternate histories, how we got there.
What's your question?
My question is regarding Nick Bostrom's simulation hypothesis, and I'm looking around the room to see if I need to summarize this or if people know what I'm talking about.
Okay,
but the problem is, if it's true that
you're surviving... Can you make it short?
I'm trying to make it short, but it's a complex idea. The thing is, if we do survive into the future, chances are we're running simulations on ourselves, and the chances are that you and I, in this room here, are not living in the real reality from which we evolved. Chances are we're living in a simulation from the future, because we're going to be running a lot of these. Even if we run only 100, that means there's only a 1% chance that we're actually living in actual physical reality versus a simulated reality.
Well, we talked about
this. This is an interesting philosophical idea.
Yeah.
The thing that bothers me is, in terms of lived experience, over the last 30 years, it seems to me that human beings are acting as if reality is less real. Human beings are acting in ways as if consequences of our actions seem to matter less and less.
Well, you can ask a Buddhist about that. And I would just like to say that when I go home today, tonight, I will leave this unrealistic world and go into the and go out of the matrix and back to the real world. I don't know about you people.
Hey, I just wanted, before I ask a question, make a couple of comments about the AI business here. I'm a programmer. You know, if you take a look at trusty machines, look at how the Boeing computers crashed the planes into the ground, right? So they were programmed, and they believed that the computer was going to be infallible and better than the pilots, and it just let it down. Now, for AI, a lot of this AI business, you have to have an outside person putting the parameters to tell it when it's doing the simulation, when a simulation is good or bad.
Yeah.
So you still have an outside creator.
Yeah.
You know, so the idea of having true, spontaneous AI, nothing like that has been done yet. Anything we've done in engineering, but it's in science fiction books. Now, if you name a couple of books that had, or stories,
yeah,
that had AI from spontaneous machines.
Yeah. Well, aren't we teaching AIs to be
improve themselves, reprogram, improve their programs. What's that called?
Machine learning.
Yeah, machine learning. Yes, and AI isn't going to be all bad. I mean, it does fantastic things for us now. You know, we could fly airplanes without it. But yes, it's got good and bad. And we've talked about AI to ad nauseum, you know, about what it can't do and what it can't do.
Okay, over here. All right, so you touched on the system one, system two thinking, you know, what you're saying about time, where we have automatic reaction to things, but we also have a capacity to reflect and think on things. So, you know, I saw the Graham Berlin over here and said, you know, that should be something that I should be doing. I saw a steak tartare over there and I said, maybe not, but what is the your system two way of thinking about the should and should not question? So, morality, ethics, is it Aristotelian, is it utilitarian?
So you're asking me what I think about what now, morality?
If you use a certain sort of analytic to answer should and should not questions of ethics.
Of what?
Just in general, do you reflect on...
when do you want to answer that question? Ethics or moral?
Well, you and I have differences in this.
Yes,
because we actually have different systems of foundations for ethics.
Yes.
Insofar as we have foundations, because we don't always have a foundation.
That's true. Morals and ethics are human constructs. We construct what's good and bad for us because that works for our survival and survival of our society. Would that work the same way for Hottentots or for, you know, people who live on Alpha Centauri? Probably not. But it works for us. These are our morals and these are our ethics and this is what we say is good, and we say is bad, etc. And so they are man-made, yes. For us, they're universal. All right? We don't kill babies for sport. And incest, even though that has been in some societies at some times, is a universal law. That's the short answer. is that good enough?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. What other questions? Time for one more question. Anybody? Okay. Well, I have a couple of announcements. A couple of further announcements. Let's give Dr. Albeck a hand here. Thank you so much, David. So next, in 2 weeks, we're going to have a topic on the environmental movement, nonviolence, deforestation, environmental movements, nonviolence, and deforestation. George King, PhD from UNT, and he's a specialist in the area of environmental philosophy. We also have, we're working on our schedule, all of our board members are diligent working on our schedule for the spring. We have sessions, lectures on symbolism, on practical science, unintended consequences, Jeremy Bentham's utilitarianism, and the nature of creativity. So we're working diligently, like I say, on crafting a great schedule for the spring. And we're also looking for a volunteer to help us with AV and with our social media. So if you're interested, we could really use some help there to bolster our membership. And we're a bunch of old white guys, and we need some fresh blood. So give that some thought. Then lastly, please pay $5 if you haven't already to David Drum. And make sure you got your bill. And thank you so much for coming. And feel free to stay longer and socialize and philosophize. Thank you. What are you doing here? Yeah.
We aren't having a meeting on Christmas Eve.
No, we skipped the fourth Tuesday in December. Fourth Tuesday in December and the fourth Tuesday in May we skipped.
Is there program material for that stuff in December and January?
Yeah, we've got the whole schedule lined out.
Is it like on a website or something?
It will be. Yeah, philosophersforum.org. It'll be on there, within probably 2 or 3 weeks, it'll be on the website.